Well, this is July 3rd. Tomorrow is July 4th. Happy Independence Day to America. This land is your land. This land is my land. This land, our land, the United States of America, is in crisis. We are deeply divided, we are conflicted, and we are facing domestic danger of tyranny. On June 16th, retired Judge Michael Luttig gave testimony at the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th assault on the Capitol. And he made a big impression on me. He was appointed to the federal bench by Bush. So of course he's a Republican. But what I appreciated, he clearly had an appreciation. He valued the US Constitution, and that's not something we find sometimes. He said, the United States is at a crossroads similar to the one the country faced during the Civil War, he stated flatly. America needs help. Reminiscent of Paul Revere in the famous midnight ride from Boston to Concord, Judge Luttig, taking no regard for his personal political safety, understood the ramifications of the July 6th assault and warned people, warned US citizens of the dire threat. Donald Trump and his allies and supporters are a clear and present danger to American democracy. I remember that terrible day, January 6th last year. I felt deeply stricken, sickened by what I was seeing on television. It was hard to comprehend the scope and scale of what my eyes were looking at. We're in trouble. We're in serious trouble. As Elizabeth was reading, as a country, we've got a problem. I recall when I lived and worked in South Africa, when I first went, it was in the 90s, 94. I was working at the parliament when it was announced that a head of state from an African country could not make his official visit because a coup had been attempted following his reelection. Monica, do you ever worry about an election coup in Chicago, in America? Someone asked. No, I confidently responded. Peaceful transition is a fundamental tenet of American democracy. And I wanted to share this little story too. I've not always felt myself to be an American. Growing up here, well, first of all, everybody's American, but I always felt my first identity was you're African American, you're Black American, with the emphasis on my skin color rather than my nationality. Living in Africa changed that. When I first went to Africa in 1994, I was astonished that people would just look at me and say, you're an American. I felt like I had made in America stamped on my forehead. In those early days where the parliament, in Cape Town where the parliament sat, the kids would say, hey, American, is Tupac really dead? Many ANC types would look at me hostile. You aren't American. And their eyes silently holding me accountable for American foreign policy. And want to say, if you think I got that kind of, well, Afrikaners would look at me and say, oh, she looks like just like one of our coloreds. But you can tell she's an American. And the Brits would haughtily assure me, well, no one ever accused an American of speaking English. And this really put the icing on the cake. I was at an international women's affair tea, and an elderly representative of the British Empire, she thought the sun still set. She was about 106 years old. She said, "It's Jeremy talking." She looked around. Dad, I'm looking. She's talking to me. I said, "Yes. Why do you insist on calling yourself an African American? Isn't American quite bad enough?" I wondered why everybody could just look at me at a glance and see that I was American. Then one day, my telephone service was cut off. Now, in the 90s, you had to have telephone service to have internet. I communicated, I was on a sabbatical from a research lab, and I had articles due, and so I had to have that fax going. You know, something, I was just cut off from my family, cut off, and I was so angry. They cut my service off, no notice, no warning, no due process. So I rushed down to the telecom office and I demanded answers. A clerk explained that my service had been disconnected due to my large number of international calls. I said, I paid a hefty deposit as a foreigner for international calls. I pay my bills on time. What is the problem? The more calls I make, the more money you make. I just didn't see the problem. So I asked to see her boss. He said the same nonsense. So I asked to see his boss. They sent me upstairs. And I walked into the office of the managing director for telecom. It's like for the whole state. And so I explained what had happened. And then I said, I don't understand, because you cut off, I paid the bills, I made the deposit, and you cut me off without any notice. What happened to due process? He just stared at me. And finally he said, "You're American. We do things differently over here." But I thought, the Constitution, the Fifth Amendment, you know, Skippy, I'm an American. And I realized that's what made me American. Americans have a certain attitude. I don't know if a lot of you travel overseas, but they say you can always tell an American. And I realized how my worldview, my expectations, all have been shaped as an American, in the American paradigm. And I had to go to Africa to discover that I'm an American. Let's take a look at democracy. In simple terms, democracy is ruled by the people. It denotes that the government belongs to the people and not the other way around. Democracy demands full participation of the people. All Americans should have more than a passing acquaintance with the foundational documents that set forth the basis of American democracy: the Declaration of Independence, and the U.S. Constitution. According to the National Archives, the Declaration of Independence states the principles on which our government and our identity as Americans are based. Abraham Lincoln called it a rebuke and stumbling block to tyranny and oppression. Somebody should go read this to a few people in Washington. The preamble to the Declaration of Independence famously reads, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all," I'm going to proof it, "that all people are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, among these life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Now, First U is an educated congregation with fine legal eagles here who are better equipped. I see my friend Hank back there, is better equipped, they're better equipped to discuss the Constitution. So I'm just gonna quote from history.com. "The US Constitution established our national government and fundamental laws and guarantees certain basic rights for its citizens. The Bill of Rights were four amendments guaranteeing basic individual protections such as freedom of speech and religion that became part of the Constitution. To date, there are 27 Constitution amendments." Now I have to tell you, I got a problem because it doesn't include the Equal Rights Amendment for women. The preamble to the, let's briefly consider the underlying conditions of our democracy's malaise. The threat to our national health and well-being did not just happen with January 6th or COVID, or even when the unthinkable happened and Donald Trump got elected. In 1980, Isaac Asimov said, "There's a cult of ignorance in the United States. Anti-intellectualism has been a constant thread winding its way through our political and social life, nurtured by the false notion that democracy means my ignorance is just as good as your knowledge." Doesn't that remind you of the COVID era? If you won't tell me you never had an anti-vaxxer explain to you that if you got the vaccination, they could follow you. If you never had someone explain to you, well, maybe I just ran into these weirdos, but I mean, it reminds me, I used to wonder, did they drop critical thinking from the schools? What's going on? A decade later, the National Science Foundation sounded an alarm. In nearly every university in that rather small group that receives the lion's share of the billions for basic science research, there were no born Americans in the physics department at the doctoral level. Moreover, the National Science Foundation, and at that time I had been seconded to the National Science Foundation. Moreover, they reported to the Congress that there were problems in the pipeline. There are faults in the pipeline. The international ranking of American high school students was slipping precipitously in math and science, a trend they had noted previously to no avail. But the Congress gave them money to revamp math and science, and that marked the beginning of STEM. Are you familiar with STEM? In the late 80s, a Harvard Business School professor wrote an article decrying the paucity of students studying management relating to manufacturing and the production sector. Everybody wants to study finance, and there was no interest in becoming the next Edward Demings. Our fascination with wealth and materialism has not served the US well. It has resulted in malignant growths and distortions in our society and in our polity. In public education, elementary and secondary schools have been in crisis for quite some time, particularly those in large urban or remote rural districts. We decry and underfund the schools, and then we blame the teachers. It made international news, I was living abroad at the time, when Mayor Rahm Emanuel publicly cursed Karen Lewis, then the president of the CUT. He belligerently yelled in her face what I can't yell in this chapel. As a great consequence to our health care, today hospitals are run by profit-driven corporations. Medical doctors are earning less. Their decisions are subject to scrutiny by insurance companies, and their work environments are zealously managed by business administrators with no medical backgrounds. Quality care is parceled out according to the economic status of the patient. This was all painfully evident in the COVID disaster. It was heart-wrenching to watch ER docs crying on television. A friend of mine asked, what does it mean when a society disparages its healers and its teachers? What does that say about that society? As for our political system, according to Robert Reich, big money has steadily gained power over the last 40 years. He chronicled this trend in his most recent book, The System: Who Rigged It, How We Can Fix It. He holds that the middle class, which grew steadily from the post-war era through the 70s, grew confident, trusting, and liberal, approving of policies and legislative initiatives for such thing as the Voting Rights Act and the Fair Housing Act. However, in the 80s, as wealth began to consolidate in the 1% of the population, the middle class began to stagnate and slowly decline. At the same time, the wealthy grew in power, buying political support for changes in laws and regulations that help make them more money. Have you ever heard the phrase, more money, more money, more money? According to Forbes, economic inequality increased in 2020 amid a COVID pandemic that drastically impacted low-wage service workers and people of color in general. This coincided with a report that the global billionaire wealth has skyrocketed at an unprecedented rate. The Fed reported the total wealth of the 1% reached $45.9 trillion. At the end of the fourth quarter of 2021. This amounts to a record 32.3% of the entire country's wealth. The share of wealth for the bottom 90% of Americans declined slightly from 30.5% to 30.2%. An NYU econ professor said, these numbers are astounding. The pandemic growth boom rivals the top of all the wealth booms over the past 40 years. The Fed itself reported that the race wealth gap in the US had expanded. White Americans hold nearly 85% of the nation's wealth, with a median of $171,000 for a white family, versus the 4.1% held by Black Americans, with a median of $17,150 for a Black family. Widening of the wealth gap itself poses a serious threat to our society. There was a time when I used to attend the World Economic Forum that sponsored in Davos. And I remember in 2013, they always announced the biggest threat in the world. And that year, it was the wealth gap. And guess who was number one? The US of A. And number two was South Africa. When I tried to talk to the students who were in my congregation, they told me, thanks for that econ lesson. They were on their way to B school in finance. They didn't want to hear none of that. I said, but your granny lives in a shack back in the middle of nowhere, walking to get water. That doesn't make sense. It, that kind of gap destabilizes the country. What can we do? Your country needs your help. As the judge said, America needs help, your service. And service is not just about the military. Our problems are not external, they are internal. On that happy note, let's address service. John Kennedy issued a call in his inaugural address, a very famous one, although I think it was a quote. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. And you're probably thinking, whoa, wait a minute. We're dealing with systemic macro issues. But remember what Dr. King said. We can't slow down and keep our dignity and self-respect. We can't slow down because of our love for democracy and for America. If democracy is ruled by the people, we the people must accept responsibility for our government. It means we the people have to endeavor to control our government to solve our problems. Our nation is at a crucial turning point. What we the people do will determine whether our democracy survives. When I lived in a former British colony, it occurred to me, the Brits ruled the world. The sun never shined. They were serious for 200 years. And I thought about the ascension of America as the world power. And given the collapse of the rate of change, I wondered, will we even get 100? Our system of government is fractured, but the harnessed, purposeful political will of the people is powerful. Consider, before government policy, legislation, and regulation were manipulated to enhance the 1%, government agency made possible the largest middle class in the world. Do you remember those days when we had a large, stable middle class? You might ask, but what about leadership? Leadership is defined by the time in which it exists and is exerted. At one time in our country, effective leadership was autocratic, hierarchical, control-driven, and top-down. That was another time, another place. It's not today. Today, leadership is not centralized. It's decentralized. It's organic. It's shared. It's based on cooperative, connected spheres of influence. It utilizes digital communications. Today, effective leaders are doers, stealth starters. They are proactive, authentic, dedicated, innovative, and imaginative. Where is the leader? Look in the mirror. Everyone can lead because everyone can serve. If we do nothing, our democracy perishes. Our actions can save our democracy. And I want to tell you, I'm banking on America. I have hope. I'm hopeful for the future of American democracy. Why? Cassidy Hutchinson gave me hope. This 26-year-old woman testified before the House Select Committee on January 6th, composed, standing firm in her beliefs in American ideals. She delivered, which is what will most likely be the most valuable testimony of all the witnesses, because she fills in all those blanks that that the committee had. She had been there. Remember Hamilton? I want to be there in the room where it happened, the room where it happened. Well, Peggy Noonan said she was in the room where it happened, and she had to be a woman because the men were walking around, strutting around, being important. She had her notebook writing every stupid thing they said. She had been in the room where it happened, but she wasn't impressed or intimidated. She testified clearly and competently about what she had seen, what happened, who did and said what. Her testimony provided missing information in the committee's record. Her courage, her resolve to speak the truth inspired me. I'm hopeful for the broader implications for mending American democracy. For Cassidy was a Trump loyalist who refuted the big lie, dismantled his fake facade, his false posturing, and calmly told the truth. I'm hopeful that her bravery will move other loyalists to break from the cult of ignorance, to listen to reason, to see through Trump's facade. I hope this will help bridge the terrible divide in our nation. I am hopeful because of Unitarian Universalists, because of your approach to principle, your value for principles, your values for diversity. I think that's important. You all need to become evangelists, preaching the gospel. I have hope because I have been victorious in hopeless situations more than once in my life. For example, pardon my language, in Chicago, it was accepted that if you went against the machine, when I was a young woman, you got your butt whooped and your money took, as many a precinct captain told me. A leading Democrat, the Attorney General of the state of Illinois, announced at a crowded political event
that I see Faith over there. She doesn't have a chance. Her race is hopeless.
A few months later, he was standing at another function, the training and welcoming of newly elected state representatives. He had to tell that, and he was gracious enough to tell that crowd. When he got to the mic, the first thing he said, I gotta apologize to Monica Faith Stewart. I predicted she would lose. Well, she's here, and she's the top vote getter in the state of Illinois. He said my situation was hopeless. I have faith. I'm a woman of faith. This is my middle name. And biblically, faith is described, and I know we all don't go for that, but faith is described as the evidence of things hoped for, the substance of things not seen. I hope as you enjoy the holiday today, tomorrow, I hope you will think about some of the things that I said. I attended a luncheon where the Old Girls Network was evident. Meanwhile, about Roe v. Wade, and it was Jan Schakowsky, a congresswoman from the North Side. It was her annual Women in Power lunch, except we haven't met, of course, for 2 years. So it was good. And so one of my friends I hadn't seen for a long time said, Monica, as women, we know one thing. You don't agonize, you organize. We can do this. Blessings. Thank you, Adam. Friends, we've gathered to worship as a community of seekers in reverence of the independence of life, respecting the dignity of all, honoring the land we humbly walk on. Let us acknowledge that we walk upon territories of indigenous nations who continue to cry out for justice and self-determination. Let us acknowledge that we enjoy the fruit of the labor of enslaved people, that our economy and our culture are tapestries woven from their works, their work, their gifts, and those of others who immigrated from many nations. Let us acknowledge the worthy desire of people seeking to come here today to enjoy what we enjoy, to share and contribute to this country. We are blessed with the space and opportunity to thrive, to live out our common principles, to bring justice, equity, and compassion into our daily lives, to resist all that threatens the earth and her people, and to live out a dream for a nation and a world of peace, liberty, and justice for all. Now, let these thoughts carry you forth as we journey forward separately yet united. Blessed be, may each of you be blessed and also be a blessing to someone else.